advisor to the State Department, John Foster Dulles, told the United Nations Association dinner that it would be impossible to contain communist aggression everywhere at once.
The free world is not without power in this respect. It has a strategic air force and a stock of weapons. The arsenal of retaliation should include all forms of counterattack with maximum flexibility, mobility, and the possibility of surprise.
After Dulles became President Eisenhower's Secretary of State in 1953, he restated his theory as the doctrine of massive retaliation. Red Scowcroft, a retired Lieutenant General of the Air Force and a former National Security Advisor, says that the Korean stalemate convinced the Eisenhower administration that if the communists used their conventional superiority, the United States would reply with technological superiority.
Instead of meeting Korea on the Korean Peninsula, we would use nuclear weapons on the Soviet Union. That was partly a way to rely on strategic forces rather than on conventional forces. In a sense, it was deterrence on the cheap.
Thermonuclear weapons, hydrogen bombs, became available in the mid-1950s, and they were much less expensive than conventional fuses. In the terminology of the 50s, you got a bigger bang for the buck.
Very soon thereafter, the Soviet Union had its own thermonuclear weapons, and the policy started looking bad almost from the beginning.
Edward Luttbach is a senior fellow at Georgetown University and the author of the forthcoming book, The Grand Strategy of the Soviet Union.
Look bad because the Russians could always say, well, we will outface your threat. You say that you will start bombarding us with thermonuclear weapons if we just invade some little country. We will invade another country anyway, and then we'll put you to the test. And let's see what happens.
This is an atom bomb threat. How do you do, ladies and gentlemen? This is Fred Henry speaking to you from the Yucca Flat at Las Vegas, New Mexico, where in just a very few moments you will join us in viewing a television historic moment. For the first time in history, an actual atom bomb blast will be seen on television, televised coast to coast. Press representatives from all over the nation are gathered here to await this great moment when this bomb will soon go off.
According to recently declassified documents, the first priority target in massive retaliation was Soviet nuclear capability. That's called counter-force targeting. Cities and population came second. That's counter-value. The Strategic Air Command was to hit the entire list at the same time, bomb as you go. One naval officer observed that SAC intended to leave the Soviet Union, quote, a smoking, radiating ruin at the end of 2 hours, unquote.
The plane is now 1 minute away from the target. Shockwave, and looking into the clouds, you see the orange, the brown, the dirty black, and the fringed white. Beautiful, tremendous, an angry spectacle on this waste and barren desert.
There was supposed to be a moral component to the Strategic Air Command's target list. We hear the same argument today. But George Quester, a professor of political science at the University of Maryland, says the weapons of the 50s made that an illusion.
To make it easier to brandish nuclear weapons, we act as if we were mainly aimed at military targets. But the reality is we would have killed millions of people. We've always found 7 or 8 military targets in Moscow and 6 or 8 in Leningrad and so on. So the emphasis on so-called counterforce or warfighting doctrine then, I think, is a subterfuge. Of course, the important point was the counter-value aspect, and that we could kill more Russians than they could kill Americans, and we would bank on that.
Mr. Nixon talks about our being the strongest country in the world. I think we are today, but we were far stronger relative to the communists 5 years ago. And what is of great concern is that the balance of power is in danger of moving with them. They made a breakthrough in missiles.
You may recall that one of the issues in the 1960 presidential campaign was the alleged missile gate. Robert McNamara was Secretary of Defense from 1961 to 1968. That missile gap was a function of Air Force intelligence estimates, which were made by honorable individuals whose judgment was incorrect. As it turned out, there wasn't any missile gap, except in our favor. But fears of impending Soviet superiority led President Kennedy and Secretary McNamara to begin a massive weapons buildup. More B-52 bombers, new Polaris missile submarines, and land-based missiles, too. The United States had 28 land-based ICBMs in 1961. They were over 1,000 8 years later. The American buildup continued long after the missile gap was proved to be a fiction. The Soviets were frightened, and former Secretary McNamara believes they had good reason. In the early 1960s, and this has only recently been revealed publicly, and it's the only reason I referred to it, there were those, in the Air Force in particular, who recommended that we build up a strategic nuclear force sufficiently powerful to give us what is technically known as a first strike capability. The President didn't think it was possible. I didn't think it was possible. If it had been possible, we would not have thought it desirable. But there were pieces of paper and was much discussion. Undoubtedly, the Soviets learned of that. Moreover, they saw what we were doing. We were building a force much, much larger than they thought we needed for deterrence only. Therefore, they became concerned that we were seeking a first strike capability. And what we saw in the latter part of the 60s and the early 70s was a response to that fear. A first strike would be designed to destroy one side's nuclear weapons before they could be fired. That might have been possible in the early 1960s, but by the middle of the decade, both sides could guarantee obliteration of the other cities in a retaliatory strike. First use of strategic weapons offered no possible advantage. This became known as mutual assured destruction, MAD for short, and since each side only had a certain number of cities, MAD offered the prospect of an agreement to limit the number of weapons. When Presidents Nixon and Podgorny toasted the signing of the Strategic Arms Limitation Treaty in 1972, it seemed that mutual assured destruction had gained official recognition. Yet within 2 years, the United States strategic doctrine had changed. Some of the reasons were technical. Missiles, for example, became more accurate. Theoretically, they could now be aimed at military bases, not just cities. Other reasons were political. Conservative hardliners became alarmed at the Soviet buildup and began questioning MAD's usefulness. Edward Luttwaffe was a Pentagon consultant at the time.
Assured destruction has not lost its validity. What it has lost is its monopoly. To deter a Soviet attack on the American population is a very easy thing. Unfortunately, that's not our problem. Our problem is not that the Russians are about to leap upon us to destroy our cities in an unprovoked attack. Our problem is that the Russians threaten countries around the world with invasion.